For the last 10 years or so, the Navy has been putting its newest equipment to the, sending it to the Pacific first.
The U.S. Navy announces big plans as it repositions in Asian waters. It's Tuesday, January 10th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington, and you're a part of the program. Join us on any of our VOA Asia social media platforms. Also ahead, difficult access for human rights observers in Myanmar, new U.S. business opportunities in Asia, a new way to safeguard dementia patients, China's space ambitions, and Indonesian singer's comeback, all on today's VOA Asia. The U.S. Navy opens the new year with some big announcements on force deployment in the Asia-Pacific region. Military experts say this is an important element of Asian rebalancing that has been in place for several years, and it's not directly related to the ongoing U.S. government power transition. VOA's Lori London is with us with more details. Lori, what is the Navy planning?
The Navy said recently it will deploy its most advanced carrier airborne early warning planes to Japan in February. A Navy statement said the E-2D Hawkeyes are capable of both mechanical and electronic sweeping with upgraded mission computer and better data link capabilities. Brian Clark, a senior fellow at Washington-based defense think tank CSBA, who was a Navy strategy analyst at the Pentagon, told VOA that these more advanced E-2Ds would allow the U.S. Navy and its allies in the region to face growing military challenges from China.
So sending that out to Japan will enable the air wing out there to detect air threats at much longer ranges. It may give it better capability against lower observable or your stealth aircraft that the Chinese might try to deploy.
2 days earlier, the Navy said that the carrier group of USS Carl Vinson would be on its way to the Western Pacific this week. According to the Navy, the deployment is part of the efforts to promote the Asia-Pacific rebalancing strategic thinking, which includes deploying the military's most advanced combat capability to the Asia-Pacific region. Some observers, however, suggest the U.S. military is strengthening its presence in the Asia-Pacific at this time to deter any attempt by adversaries to test U.S. resolve during the presidential transition period. But both Brian Clark and Michael McDevitt, a retired U.S. Navy Rear Admiral, said the deployment announcement is part of the ongoing Asia rebalance and not directly related to U.S. administration transition.
For the last 10 years or so, the Navy has been putting its newest equipment, sending it to the Pacific first, because, among other things, to make sure that U.S. Navy capabilities keep pace with Chinese modernization that is taking place.
Beijing has said that its military modernization is aimed at safeguarding its national security interests.
Thanks, Lori. That's VOA's Lori London. Also, the U.S. Navy is handing the Third Fleet more abilities similar to its role back in World War II. The strike group promises to give commanders all the way up to the president more options, either in the rare event of waging war against an enemy or by responding to humanitarian crises such as the massive 2004 earthquake and tsunami near Indonesia that wreaked havoc on 14 coastal nations. These are among the top stories that are currently trending in Asia. East Asia quiet as U.S.-North Korea tensions escalate over ICBM test. Philippines cool to the United States explores military relationship with Russia. McDonald's sells China business for $2 billion. Ted Cruz, Texas governor, meets with Taiwanese president. China's poorest trying to stay warm adds greatly to smog. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at the voanews.com website. Also, be sure to check us out on VOA Asia on Facebook. I'm Jim Stevenson, and this is VOA Asia. Fighting between Myanmar government and a conscience state ethnic armed group broke out over the weekend, just as Yonhi Lee, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Myanmar, was trying to visit a refugee camp in the vicinity. She told a VOA Burmese reporter that she did not get any cooperation from the Myanmar authorities in her Kachin trip. She arrived in Myanmar Sunday and visited Kachin State, where the fighting took place. She met Monday with Kachin CSOs and some representatives of the Kachin refugee camp. However, she could not actually visit the camp and other areas where she wanted to go.
Well, I'm not getting any cooperation from the state nor the union government in giving me access to areas that I have requested, because that is under my mandate. My mandate is to monitor human rights violations and abuses, and they're not letting me go to those places where there are serious human rights violations and abuses.
Yonhi Lee is also scheduled to visit Rakhine State, where local Muslims were allegedly being subjected to human rights abuses. She did not say whether she is allowed to visit there or not. The government spokesperson said the local authority would provide her with security to visit the conflict-ridden areas. VOA asked Chaw Tay, Burmese government spokesperson, why the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Myanmar was not allowed access in certain areas.
We cannot allow her to go there because of the local situation. In fact, it's very difficult. There are a lot of landmines and fighting throughout the route, and we need to negotiate with both sides in order to pass through. But because of the current situation on the ground, it can't be negotiated, so she simply can't go there.
UN Human Rights Representative Yonhi Lee is in Myanmar on a 12-day visit as the international community raises concern about reports of abuses of Muslim minority in Rakhine State and military tensions in Kachin and northern Shan State in a government security crackdown. In early October, attackers killed 9 police officers in a coordinated assault on posts near Myanmar's border with Bangladesh. Authorities say members of the Rohingya minority carried out the attacks, prompting the launch of a security sweep. Since then, at least 86 people have been killed, and the United Nations says about 34,000 civilians have fled across the border to Bangladesh. Residents and refugees accuse the military of killing, raping, and arbitrarily detaining citizens while burning villages in northwestern Rakhine State. The government, led by Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi, denies the accusations and insists a lawful counterinsurgency operation is underway. More information and updates are available at voanews.com. And happening now in Asia, Russia and the Philippines are considering joint naval exercises. It's a link that would advance Manila's move toward a multi-country foreign policy and bulk up its military. Moscow sent a destroyer and a naval oil tanker to a port in Manila last week for a 5-day goodwill visit. Stay up to date with VOA. Once he becomes president on January 20th, how will Donald Trump really deal with trade in Asia, and specifically China? Alibaba chief Jack Ma was at Trump Tower today. He had a positive meeting with the president-elect.
Oh, he has the concerns, and he has solutions, and he wants to discuss with China and us that how we can do better. Now, I advise and suggest that we can go through the business community to understand the situation better and do it in a better way.
Based in Hangzhou, China, Alibaba sells to 450 million online customers and is rapidly growing its market share. That's made Jack Ma one of the richest men in Asia, and it gives him a natural business connection with Donald Trump's interest in boosting U.S. companies. Trump seems to be looking to Alibaba to help sell U.S. products to Asia.
No, we are specifically talking about we will create, supporting 1 million small business, especially in the Midwest of America. Small business on the platform, selling products, agriculture products, and American services to China and Asia, because we're pretty big in Asia, Southeast Asia.
So what might you be able to buy from the United States soon?
The agriculture products and also some products like garments and product of wine and fruits.
The seemingly cordial and calming tone toward China helped Alibaba's stock on U.S. financial markets rise slightly, as well as U.S. giant online retailer Amazon. Healthcare reform is also a big issue for Donald Trump. Here's a system in Japan he might want to look at concerning dementia patients. The World Health Organization says more than 47 million people are living with dementia worldwide. That number is projected to increase to 75.6 million by 2030 and keep rising. VOA's Steve Miller shares how one Japanese community is addressing the issue.
In many countries around the world, if you're standing at a bus stop and want to know more information about a route, you can take out your mobile phone and scan a small square-shaped checkered box called a QR code. The mobile device connects to the internet and pulls down the requested information. It's a simple and effective tool and an idea that's being applied in Japan to help identify members of the society with dementia. A sticker is attached to a finger or thumbnail with a QR code containing the address, contact number, and a national ID number. Hasegawa now at Irumashi City Hall.
We have stickers that can be attached to clothes or shoes, but when they change, those stickers cannot be with them. So the biggest merit of QR codes is that the codes are able to be attached to the patients all the time, whenever they go, and whatever they wear.
In Japan, they're known as Heikai Korisha, or roaming elderly. The stickers will allow police or city officials to get help for people who wander because they are suffering from dementia. The service is currently being tested in a trial phase and is being offered free of charge. Most local residents, like Kuke Machiko, have a positive reaction.
I would love to use the system. My mother passed away at the age of 94, and it was a real struggle to take care of her, even though she was not suffering from dementia. I really think this helpful system should be introduced.
The system could be particularly helpful in Japan, where more than a quarter of its citizens are 65 or over. Reporting for Kevin Enix in Washington, I'm Steve Miller.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news alert from VOA Asia. China says it opposes any contact between Taiwanese leaders and U.S. officials. That coming a day after Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen met with U.S. Senator Ted Cruz and Texas Governor Greg Abbott in Houston, where she stopped on her way to Central America. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3.
China's recently issued white paper on its space program contains new revelations about its ambitions to rival the United States and Russia in exploring the moon, Mars, and beyond. Michael Lippin is here to tell us more.
Well, that policy paper that you mentioned, which was published by the Chinese government on December 27th, it talks about China's latest space achievements, as well as what it hopes to accomplish in the next 5 years. One of the people that we hear from in the podcast is Morris Jones. He's an independent researcher on the Chinese space program and is based in Australia. He told our colleague Victor Beatty that the white paper is noteworthy for what it says about China's plans for lunar exploration. Plans that go beyond an already known project for a first-ever soft landing of a probe on the moon's far side in 2018.
It's a very ambitious technical challenge to land on the far side of the moon because there is no direct line of sight to the Earth,
and therefore no direct line of communication. So they've got to use some very advanced technology, including a special communication satellite in a very unusual orbit so that ground controllers can talk to that lander. But what I also think is interesting to consider is the fact that the white paper gives further hints that even beyond landing robot probes on the moon, China is moving steadily in the direction of eventually sending humans there.
The probe that would attempt a soft landing on the far side of the moon next year is called Chang'e 4. Ahead of that, China is proceeding with another previously announced mission, sending the probe Chang'e 5 to the near side of the moon later this year to collect samples and bring them back to Earth. Now, Andrew Jones is a Finland-based journalist who covers China's space program for GB Times. He tells us via Skype that the white paper also does more than just reiterate China's lunar plans for Chang'e 4 and 5.
In the paper, it does mention that beyond these two missions, there will be, in the early 2020s, missions to the lunar poles, which, again, would be groundbreaking missions. So what they would be probably looking at is there are permanently shadowed craters on the poles, which are full of water ice. Now, those could be very useful resources if you wanted to, for example, have a crewed or a human outpost on the moon. At the same time, they're also areas which are permanently lit in sunlight, and again that would be very useful for resources for energy. So these are very interesting missions which show that China has very serious plans for exploration of the moon.
China has not explicitly said when it might send humans to the moon, something the U.S. last did in 1972. The white paper also repeats China's plan to launch its first interplanetary mission in 2020, a mission to Mars involving an orbiter, a lander, and a rover. But Andrew Jones says the document makes a first official reference to an even more significant Chinese goal for Mars exploration.
What had also been mentioned in plans but not officially approved was a potential sample return mission to Mars around 2030. So that would involve sending a probe to Mars, landing, collecting samples, and bringing them back to Earth. So that could be something which could change human history.
The white paper also has drawn international scrutiny for what it does not say about China's space program, its military dimensions. Jim?
Great work, Michael. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Jim.
At this hour in Asia, fast food giant McDonald's is selling a controlling stake in its mainland China and Hong Kong business. It's a deal worth more than $2 billion. McDonald's says the partnership and company will be the master franchisee responsible for all of McDonald's business in that area for the next 20 years. VOA Asia keeps you informed all day on Facebook at VOA Asia. That's Indonesian singer Irma June. It's been many years since you've heard new music from her, but she's seeking to make a comeback in both her homeland and the United States. VOA Indonesian reporter Ariano Arifin tells us about this possible high note of Irma June's career. Cinta kita kekal
selamanya. Irma June singing Cristal Cristal Cinta, or Love Crystals, her hit song from 1989. Irma June came out of her 18-year hiatus to release a new album from the U.S. meant to be heard by both American and Indonesian audience. Her first single, called It's Me, is a departure from her romantic ballads with a touch of 80s disco.
Kayaknya bisa dibilang tuh agak different ya, gitu. Kalau nggak dibilang totally different, ya a bit different karena musiknya disco.
It's a bit different from what I used to record. It's fun, it's different. But I sing any kind of song anyway, from pop to opera to traditional music, so I didn't really have trouble singing it.
In the 1990s, Irma June's distinctive raspy voice and pop ballads dominated the airwaves. But since 1999, Irma had to put her career on hold to focus her time and energy on family, the family business, and bringing up her two children.
Sebenarnya sih, 18 tahun tuh masa 18 tahun vakum dari industri kali ya gitu. Tapi aku nyanyi di untuk gospel music.
Nobody asked me to quit my career. I did it for myself. I might stop singing for the industry, but I still sing, mostly gospel music. And I've been focusing more on family business, going back and forth between Indonesia and the US.
Irma decided to heed the call of her musical passion that never really left her. So she recorded and released her first single in the United States, titled It's Me.
Suami support banget, anak-anak support banget, ternyata keluarga support banget. Terus dari situ baru mulai membuka diri lagi ke publik.
My husband is very supportive, and he got me in touch with musicians from Nashville. They offered me the opportunity to record songs here in the US, and I said yes.
Irma plans to record more songs and release them before launching the entire album in 2017 and going on tour. She said she would focus on the American audience. Irma says that although record sales is very competitive in the US, she's confident her music can be accepted by Indonesian and American audiences.
Yang menyatu dalam hatiku tak akan pudar selamanya sampai akhir hayatku. Cinta kita kekal selamanya.
Our thanks to VOA Indonesian reporter Ariano Arifin. And you've been listening to VOA Asia. We're here each and every weekday bringing you stories in conjunction with our great reporters in the East Asia Pacific region and right here in Washington. Be sure to follow us and like us on Facebook. The name is VOA Asia. You can also find us on our website at voanews.com. It's filled with all of our stories, audio, photos, video. It all comes daily from our East Asia and Pacific reporters and the great folks that bring you VOA Asia. Thanks so much for joining us. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Dave Magnus. We even have a managing editor. Her name is Diane Gao. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Enjoy the day. Let's get back together again tomorrow at the same time.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, will provide $227.3 million in additional development assistance to support the five-year, $2.3 billion agreement signed with the Nigerian government in 2015. The aid package brings the total provided under the agreement to $702 million. The new funding will continue to help Nigeria reduce extreme poverty by stimulating economic growth, promoting a healthier, more educated population, and strengthening good governance. We are pleased to announce new funding under the agreement signed with the Nigerian government in 2015 to provide better access to education and health services and promote democracy and economic growth, said U.S. Ambassador Stuart Symington. With the Nigerian government's leadership, we know this funding will significantly improve the well-being of Nigerians, he added. In addition to development assistance funding, the United States is providing humanitarian aid to people affected by the ongoing conflict and severe food insecurity in northeastern Nigeria and throughout the Lake Chad Basin. The United States has provided more than $291 million in humanitarian assistance since fiscal year 2016 and continues to be the single largest bilateral humanitarian donor to the region. USAID partners to end extreme poverty and promote resilient, democratic societies while advancing American security and prosperity. In its partnership with Nigeria, the United States strengthens social stability through social services, supports transparent and accountable governance, promotes a more market-led economy, and enhances Nigeria's capacity as a responsible regional and trade partner. The United States is proud to work with Nigeria to promote the prosperity of the people of Nigeria and the African region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.